He was told he must fight for his country if he wanted to keep his family out of internment camp. From SDPB, today is Friday, November 8th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the story of Kenny Higashi. Higashi grew up in Spearfish and was the son of Japanese immigrants. Children's author Lauren Harris is with us. Her book is called A Place for Harvest, the story of Kenny Higashi, and it recounts the life and honorable service of a South Dakota U.S. Army veteran. South Dakota musician Jesse Kristen has new music out. SDPB's Carl Gerke talks with him about his electric guitar and the future of blues. That's coming later in the hour. But first, Stu Whitney from South Dakota Newswatch offers key takeaways from the election, including what's next for legislative leadership. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Republicans won big on Election Day, especially in South Dakota. Now it's time for campaigns to work out what went right, what went wrong. It's also time for state legislators to select their leadership. Stu Whitney is a columnist with South Dakota Newswatch. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio with key takeaways. You can find his reporting at sdnewswatch.org.
I think generally there is a feeling, among some of these ballot measures that even though it's a conservative state, there is room to reach moderate slash progressive voters on some of these things, and we've seen it before. I think that that was what they were hoping for with this abortion measure, mainly because of because the current law in South Dakota is so restrictive. The problem was that the opposition of the abortion amendment was very organized and had a ton of money. And we saw some of the out-of-state large donations rolling in late. I think they got to $3.5 million, something like that. And so Dakotans for Health, depending on who you ask, you know, was outnumbered or outspent 3-1, 4-1. But I think it was also some organizational issues there. As I said in my key takeaway story on South Dakota Newswatch, ACLU and Planned Parenthood decided not to get on board with Amendment G early on. They had concerns about whether it was the right time for it, maybe about some of the language. For whatever reason, they were not on board. And I think you saw kind of a lack of coherent messaging and certainly a lack of coherent organizational strategy on what the campaign should look like and a lack of money, you know, that would have come in if Planned Parenthood and some other groups were involved. So I think a variety of factors, but certainly not a great night for Dakotans for Health, because they also had that grocery tax measure, that repeal measure that went down hard, and also had some concerns about language. And we could go, you know, that's a long-winded topic about how that happened, but it is the perception. Just like with abortion, the perception ended up being that it was too extreme, because that's what the messaging hammered into people's heads for a month or more. The people's perception of the grocery tax repeal was that the language was flawed and it was going to lead to budget problems. Some partially true, partially exaggerated, but that was the perception.
Yeah. All right. So Trump does well. Dusty Johnson does phenomenally well. And also, let's go back to what you were saying about the Republican Party extending its edge in peer.
Yeah, so you've got a situation now where I was talking to some people, and you know, there might be some committees that don't even have a Democrat on it just because they're spread so thin and scheduling. And so sort of the ultimate in impotence, in governmental impotence, is what we're seeing with Democrats right now, where they're not even going to be reflected on some of these committees. And I think that is bad news. I think personally it's bad news just for every citizen of South Dakota, because you'd like to have some balance there. You know, there is the democracy sort of is built upon that separation of powers and the balance between parties and sort of having a watchdog. And so obviously the voters have spoken, and no one is suggesting that that we should not put in people that were lawfully voted in by people in their district. But it is, I think, you know, you keep waiting kind of for a swing back a little bit. Anytime you have a trend in politics like we've seen, where Republicans have completely taken over with this super duper majority. And 20 years ago, you had three congressional delegates in Washington that were Democrats from South Dakota. So is it going to swing back? Perhaps. Is it going to swing back in the next few years? Definitely not.
Yeah, hard to see. What that also means, though, is that the Republican Party is not necessarily going to be in unison, you know, for everything. Leadership elections are coming up here. What are you looking forward to, and who might be leading these parties, or this party, I guess?
That's kind of the $64,000 question right now. When you have only one party in power, then it becomes the story becomes the divisions within the party, as you mentioned. So the populist movement had a good night. The pipeline issue that has been animating a lot of their rise, the no on referred law 21, it's weird to say no won, but essentially the opposition to that law brought the amendment. And they won with almost 60% of the vote. So that almost strengthened that sort of mandate that these populist, what some people call far-right Republicans, believe that they have going into this session. So a long way of answering your question that no one knows yet who's going to win these leadership votes, but they're going to be very close. Some of them, could be on the razor's edge. And I know that they were looking at some of these legislative elections hoping that some of the moderates did not get knocked off because they need every vote they think they can get. And there were some, ones in Sioux Falls that were sort of nip and tuck where they thought maybe a Democrat might be able to pick off a seat and that would get rid of a moderate. That didn't happen. So, I would think the establishment is pretty good at sort of rallying their forces. I'm uncomfortable predicting that right now because even people that are more knowledgeable about it than I, who are in the ring, are not predicting it.
Right. And whoever does come out on top, it doesn't necessarily have, the task ahead of them, they're going to have some real challenges to hold people together and to get the caucus to all agree on something that's
correct.
Tough. Yeah.
That we can agree on.
Other key takeaways. Where do you want to go next here? Minnehaha County? How about that?
Yeah. I think a lot of people you talk to, you mentioned, what was the energy of the night? A lot of it was negative energy directed at the Minnehaha County Administration Building because...
Well, there are no problems. The problem must settle somewhere.
Exactly, yeah.
Minnehaha County Auditor.
Yeah, as someone said, regardless of your political ilk, one thing they can all agree on is that on election night, they like to sit around and watch results roll in. That's kind of the whole ball game. And when you keep seeing this 0% for Minnehaha, and the results are coming in elsewhere, and it's the state's largest county, so it will affect every race. Frustration is, putting it mildly, and it developed into anger as we got into the wee hours of the morning. There was it still at 0% at midnight, and that's inexcusable. And we've seen some of that from Minnehaha County in the past. Bob Litz, the Bob Litz era, he was kind of a punchline for some of that stuff. But, I talked to a Republican legislator yesterday. He said this was worse. And Leah Anderson has been not shy about shaking up the status quo. She's been not shy about occasionally touting conspiracy theories about lack of election security, which people are alarmed at since she is in charge of elections in the state's largest county. And this is not going to add – well, this will add to her resume, but not in a positive manner, the fact that this was an S show, as they say, well into the morning and the next day. Yeah. And that upset a lot of powerful people.
Okay, in her defense, and we'll invite her on the program, of course, but this is the biggest county. They had the most absentee ballots, a lot of them to go through. The county has grown. They don't have a big budget for essential functions. Anything else that the auditor would probably say in defense? Be patient.
Well, I think
this is how it's supposed to work. I'm doing it right. Everybody calm down.
I think she will say that she's not allowed to start processing absentee ballots until the day of the election. There's an open question about whether they actually started doing that when they were able to, or whether that was a delayed process. South Dakota, and this is also in my story, key takeaways of the election at South Dakota News Watch, one of the few states that does not allow processing before the day of the election. And, a lot of states are now moving toward...
By processing, you even open the...
You can't
even open the envelope.
Getting them in position to count.
Yeah, okay,
and
yeah.
A lot of states are going toward counting before the election, too. Obviously not releasing the results of that count. But I don't think that'll fly in South Dakota because of so many... Because election integrity/security is such an issue. But I think the processing perhaps is worthy of discussion. And I talked to Tony Venhuizen, and he was very vocal about this on election night and continues to be vocal that maybe it's something they should look at in the state legislature.
Yeah. We talked recently about the polling that came from Newswatch, Mason Dixon, Cheeseman Center for Democracy at USD, that I just call it the Newswatch poll, but there's other people behind it in the partnership. However, it seems to me like the polls were pointing in the direction that the voters eventually went. Were there any notable exceptions to you, or do you feel like those polls were useful looks at how public opinion was shifting, and then we had all that money in the last week? Anything that you want to circle back to on that?
I think it was useful. It showed the momentum, and it was undeniable. And if anything, the momentum was stronger than we knew because some of those polls showed it as close, like the abortion thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you asked me that day, is it too close to call, which I had also said in my story. But then, you know, gut feeling, you're thinking, if this thing is swayed or shifted 20 points in the last few months, then it's probably not too close to call in the end, which it wasn't. And, you know, you have to start thinking about direct democracy, which has been a big deal in South Dakota for going back a century, and ballot initiatives. And it's been a way in a state that there is almost no chance of progressive policy percolating through the state legislature. It's been a way to address some of those issues and in some cases change the law. Rick Weiland from Dakotans for Health, former Senate candidate in South Dakota, has been kind of the poster child of that for many years. And, you know, you kind of lick your wounds after the night that his group had, and then you start to assess whether the political climate in South Dakota is such that those things are going to be able to pass in the near future. I mean, I'm sure they will be resilient and come up with other issues to put forth. But I think there needs to be a postmortem on if you're not going to have the organizational strength that we just talked about, the lack of it around the abortion measure. If you're not going to have a coalition of partners that are stakeholders for that issue, and you're not going to be able to raise the money that you need, then maybe, you know, when do you put on the brakes and, you know, get that stuff in line before you submit your language and things like that.
Yeah. Did you hear from the Amendment G, the no on G people, about is there anything next? Is it waiting to see what abortion rights advocates want and then responding to it? Or did they give any indication that now that they have that ground game that they feel really good about, that there is room for other restrictions or other what they might call pro-life legislation?
Well, I mean, there's not much more room to go in South Dakota, unless you're going to take out life of the mother. They've pretty much taken them all out. But Leslie Unruh, I think, is looking nationally. She's emboldened by this result. She, I think, deserves a lot of credit from people on that side of the fence, I think, for a lot of the organizational muscle that was brought in. She has a lot of national connections. She's been doing this a long time. Not to demean John Hansen's role in it, but Leslie Unruh, it seemed like kind of took more and more of a leadership role. And when I talked to her on election night, she was talking in national terms. And obviously, if you're the pro-life movement, you would like some sort of federal abortion ban. Trump has said that that's not his goal, that he wanted to leave it to the states. Some people didn't believe him. I guess we'll find out pretty quickly now that he's going to have a possible trifecta in Washington. I think we'll find out pretty soon where they're going to go on that issue.
You see anything happening with Governor in this next legislative session now that Donald Trump is headed back as president-elect? Do you think what's a good play for her right now? Does she shift to Washington? Does she finish strong as governor of South Dakota? What do we know about her?
Well, you can look for some reporting on this on Monday at South Dakota News Watch. I'm doing a kind of a look ahead on, and it'll definitely have a section on Governor Noem. You know, she's made no secret of the fact that she wants to be part of the administration. And, you know, what are the dominoes that start falling if she makes that move? I'm going to actually do a little bit of a cliffhanger and have people wait to read my story on that. But suffice it to say, there will be some dominoes falling if she were to not complete her term and go to Washington.
That's South Dakota Newswatch's Stu Whitney. You can find his full reporting online at sdnewswatch.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Sometimes the person you want to meet most happens to live right down the street. Journalist and children's author Lauren Harris grew up in military towns when she heard stories about Japanese-American soldiers who went to war in order to keep their families out of internment camps. She wanted to know more. Fortunately, she lived in Spearfish. We first heard her story after the South Dakota Historical Society Press published her book. It's called A Place for Harvest, the story of Kenny Higashi. Higashi grew up in Spearfish on his family's vegetable farm. He was the son of Japanese immigrants, but his life changed on December 7th, 1941, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. As Veterans Day approaches, we reached out for more of this compelling story of community and country. Here's Lauren Harris.
Well, as I tell children, everyone has a story, and we just need to ask what it is, and you never know what you're going to find out. But like you mentioned, I did grow up in a military family. We traveled across the country, lived in various different places. And I remember as we would be in a new area, just thinking about the history of that area. So it gave me a great love for the United States and our history. And just knowing, I had a great curiosity to know more about our history. And so that never left me. It just increased. And then I became a teacher. I taught fifth grade. And then I taught my own children at home. And that, of course, we spent a lot of time studying history. And so I just feel like there's so many things we can learn from the people in our past. Yeah. And so when I became a journalist, I actually worked for features at the Rapid City Journal. I would write the good things that people want to hear about, not so much the news, but I realized that there are many people in our communities that have stories to tell, and we don't know what they are because they don't get to tell them. And they're wonderful stories of community and kindness and giving and sharing of their talents and abilities and resources. And it's just wonderful that that's out there. And it got me thinking, you know, what other stories can we tell? And it reminded me of a story from my family that was centered around the events of World War II. Mm. And that story became my first book, The Plum Neighbor, where the family in the story realizes that their neighbors, who are Japanese Americans and they love them very much, are going to be taken, forcibly removed from their homes simply because from their homes there simply because they were Japanese American. And they knew that that was wrong and they were very upset by it. So they did something about it and they helped their neighbors. And it's a wonderful story because their son went to war, and while he was gone, there's a twisty ending, and it's a happy one. Mm-hmm. And it's just a wonderful story of reciprocal kindness and their love for the United States and their home and the people around them. And so that, while I was researching that, is when I met Kenny. Mm-hmm. And I know from and I tell this to children, I get to the opportunity to visit through school visits, and then sometimes I'll do virtual visits as well. And I'm able to say the best way to know a story is by asking someone who was there, of what we call a firsthand source. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if while I'm researching this book that I'm writing about people during World War II in Europe, in a small forest in France, you know, a small area, wouldn't it be great if I met someone who was actually there? And one of my friends, we lived in Spearfish at the time, she said, oh, I think you need to meet Kenny Higashi. And he almost literally lived down the street from me.
He's your neighbor.
Couldn't believe it. He was my neighbor.
Oh,
so goodness. I went to visit him. He was 94 years old. Mm. And he had pretty much not told his story of his actions during World War II. He really hadn't talked about it, which is very common for that generation and those people that fought for our freedoms. They really a lot of them did not talk about it, which is okay. I understand that.
So you but just showed up as not a family member and said, I want to hear some of this story. And
yeah.
And how did that go? Like, that had to be a difficult ask, but with a big reward. Tell me about that moment.
Yes. Well, we when I first came in, I think he was a little bit amused because I was so eager to ask him. But I did know some of the background just from my own research. And so that I think that intrigued him because people around him didn't really know some of the places he had been and some of the, the dates and the circumstances surrounding what had happened. And so I think that opened him up, and I'm just thankful. I don't really know how to explain why he felt like he could confide in me or share these things. I did visit him several times over the next few years, and he was beginning stages of dementia. But he would sometimes turn to me and say, why are you asking me all these questions? And I would say to him, because people need to know, but more specifically, the next generations need to know. They need to know what you did. Mm-hmm. And so that is how that it came about that I met Kenny. And when I realized what he was telling me, I knew that his story also had to be told.
Yeah. As the keeper, one of the keepers of these artifacts, these photos, you gave a wonderful presentation to the South Dakota Historical Society Foundation that we'll put a link up to on our website so people can see some of the images. You become part of the story as well. Tell me a little bit about finding your place within it as the narrator, the archivist, but also as someone who is deeply moved by this.
Yeah, well, sometimes I do feel like somebody works in a museum and is putting things up and trying to display the truth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know that the truth is not always good. But when we share the truth, we need to share all of it. And I think that that's what I've discovered with this the most, is that this is our story. This is America's story. This is, and specifically for when we're talking about A Place for Harvest, the story of Kenny Higashi, that story belongs to Spearfish. It belongs to South Dakota, and it belongs to Americans. And I feel like that's kind of where we need to take these stories, is take them to heart and realize that the people who did things in our past, like Kenny and his friends in the 100th or 42nd All Japanese American unit in World War II, they were thinking about us, and they were thinking about our children and our children's children, and that was what motivated them to do things that seem absolutely amazing and extraordinary. So they were very seemingly ordinary people. They felt ordinary, but they did extraordinary things in the face of a bigger picture. They were able to say, this is not just for me. It is for me and my family, but it's more than that. And I think that kind of motivation can be applied to all different kinds of situations. And on a small level, or what we feel like is small to us, just people around us, we can make a difference to the people around us just by showing kindness and doing good and thinking about them.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's maybe where this took me. I started out loving the history, loving the context, putting the real understanding more about the pictures and the places, but then it became something much more meaningful. And that's what makes me so excited about sharing it, especially with children.
And you mentioned the truth is not always good. And often I find during Veterans Day, there is a lot of flag waving and a lot of uncomplicated stories of honor and sacrifice. And those are good things for Americans to spend time thinking about. However, there is also this overlay in this story of complexity of Japanese Americans being sent to internment camps, of the fear and mistrust of the threats on the Higashi family. They're under an incredible amount of pressure. Tell us some of what's happening in their lives in Spearfish and how the people of Spearfish respond.
Yes, and I am really glad you asked that, because I was able to talk to several people who remembered the events surrounding the Higashi family in 1942. I wasn't able to get exact details from anyone, at least in the government, but people in the community recalled. And I feel like the more I asked, I went into it with an open mind. I wanted to understand what was going on. But the more I talked to people, it was almost all the same exact sentiment, that they loved the Higashis. The Higashi family had moved there in the early 1900s from Japan. All the children were born in South Dakota, and they loved it. They were happy to have a little farm and help out. People recalled Kenny's dad just showing up to lend a helping hand on the farms that were out in the community. He would help in other different ways. And he also was very kind to the children in the community. And Kenny had that same, he carried that on. People recalled how kind he was to people, that the little people, if you will.
Yeah.
And so that people in the town, when they realized what was going on in the country and that this may actually affect their community directly, they rose up and said, this will not happen to us, because there is no reason for this. It's not right, and we will not allow it. And I found that this is actually, I've had many, many people read my books and come to me and say, my grandparents did this too for their Japanese American neighbors, or their community saved their farm and paid all the taxes, grew all the crops, saved all of the proceeds. And then when they returned from the camps, they gave it all back. Mm. I found that this is very common, because people knew that it wasn't right, and they wanted to do something about it. And they couldn't fight the big machine of the government, but they could do something for the people that were in their lives. And I feel like that's what Spearfish did. Mm-hmm. I did also find in my research that South Dakota, the governor, was approached by the federal government to have an incarceration camp for Japanese Americans built in South Dakota. And his response was that the people of South Dakota would not approve of that. So he declined.
I thought we had one for Germans though.
Yes, I did hear about that one,
yeah.
But specifically for the Japanese Americans, they declined. So I think that speaks a lot to the people. I think maybe that's a little bit, I've heard about that, but yeah, you talking about POWs, or are you actually talking about Americans?
Oh, I'm talking about POWs. Yep.
Okay. So that was a little bit different.
Yeah. But and I think that's a great moment where you see, when you're having these conversations, how another door opens. And then you think, well, don't you want to know everything about that too? Don't you want to know that? That's what happens when you start hearing these stories. Tell me about his wartime service then.
So Kenny enlisted in February of 1942, and he was sent into the army. As I tell the story in the book, that's what he told me, that's how it happened. So he was approached, told his family could stay and not have to go to the camps if he went to war. So it was a choice between him or his brother. One of them had to choose, and he volunteered. He said his brother had more skills to help his mom and his sisters at that point. His father was deceased. And so he enlisted, and he went, and they kind of bumped him around the army a little bit. I was able to follow his military record and give a timeline for him because of a gentleman in Hawaii who is really good at researching these things. And he had uncles in the same unit. So he was able to help me with that. And so Kenny was eventually attached to the 100th, which was a group of Hawaii National Guard and volunteers who were finally allowed to enlist. They were all Japanese American descent. And so they came to, I believe they went to Wisconsin first. I always get this mixed up. And then they went to Mississippi, but it may have been the other way around. But they went through boot camp twice, which is really interesting because they went through boot camp. They were all ready to go. And then they added a huge number of volunteers, combined them together, and they were considered the 442nd at that point, Regimental Combat Team. And so they all together went over to, first they went to North Africa, then he went to Italy, then he went to France, and then he went back to Italy with the unit. And he was able to tell me some of his responsibilities. He was guarding the medics. He said that it was kind of understood during wartime that the medics were given a pass. They were not supposed to be shot at when they were on the battlefield tending to the wounded.
Yeah.
But the Nazis didn't get that memo. So he had to go, they had to have a guard detail. So that was one of his jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw some very horrible things. And I didn't ask him pointed questions about that, those kinds of things.
Right.
I just let him tell me what he wanted to tell me. But oftentimes he would have to stop. And he was overcome with emotion, and just I really wanted to respect that. But I'm just, again, very grateful that he shared what he did. He participated in a very famous battle in October of 1944, which was just commemorated for the 80th anniversary in France, in the little villages of Brière and Bellefontaine. To this day, they still commemorate and celebrate the 100th, 442nd for the rescue of their towns, still to this day. So they had a big celebration.
What are some of the things that you think we can learn about ourselves through this story, and about America through this story today?
I feel like we've had culture shifts over time in this country. And lately it seems like people are not remembering what has been done for us by people like Kenny and his friends and all the other World War II veterans. They went into it, and other wartime veterans as well. I count all of them, because they all, to me, when I've talked to many different ones over the years, they all had the goal of protecting our freedoms. At some point, the freedoms of that we enjoy were jeopardized in some way, and they felt like this was what they could do. Mm-hmm. So they sacrificed, some of them, literally their lives at the moment, but even the ones that came back were so deeply affected by what they had seen and done. It was a lifetime sacrifice. So I feel like it's really important for us, and to teach this to the children and anyone that comes after that we need to respect that they made a choice to sacrifice themselves for us. And regardless of what we think about all of the details surrounding government choices and things like that, these individuals chose to sacrifice their lives for our good. And so we need to respect that, and we need to honor that. And then think about what we might do. I tell kids, you know, you feel ordinary, but you can do extraordinary things for the people around you if you are thinking about them and what would be best for them. And so there are some real universal truths that we can apply from the sacrifices that we observe that were done for us in past wartime.
Yeah, thank you for that. The book is called A Place for Harvest, the story of Kenny Higashi. My guest has been Lauren Harris, the author. Thank you so much for being here and telling us a bit more of this story. We really appreciate it this Veterans Day.
Thank you.
South Dakota musician Jesse Kristen has a new album. It's called Don't Forget to Tip the Band. The LP release is coming up on November 15th. SDPB's Carl Gerke sat down with Jesse.
What was the genesis of this album? How did it all come together?
Ooh, well, I guess I started playing with Ruben and Dan probably 2019, 2020.
That's Ruben Rodriguez, the bass player in this.
Yep.
Daniel Heyer, the drummer.
Drummer, probably familiar to many Sioux Falls live music fans or familiar faces on the local scene. And the last original project I did would have been in 2016. And I figured it was time that I better do another record because I'm not getting any younger. And these are just songs. This is stuff that, tunes that I had that I guess I liked so well that I remembered. You know, stuff that when I'd pick up a guitar, I'd just start playing. And I was, that's always kind of my rule of thumb. If you can remember it, you know you got something good.
So these are songs that you've been playing for a long time or for a while, and that you enjoyed, and you wanted to preserve them on an album.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of runs the whole gamut. I mean, there's one song, the title track from the record, "Don't Forget to Tip the Band," that goes back to the Brian Massick and Friends band. That was the last recording that I did back in 2016. This was one of the last original songs we did that never got recorded. All the way up to where there's one song on here that I wrote in the studio. So it kind of runs the full 8 years in between.
How did this album come together in the studio? Did you have full arrangements that you had prepared for Dan and Ruben, or did you just kind of work them out during the recording process?
Well, you know, we got together several times just to run the song so everybody knows. There's a couple of them that have kind of tricky. Like, I'll go back to that title track one. That's kind of my jazz fusion odyssey. That one's got some notes in it and some changes to where there's ones that, you know, that it's just kind of a cool groove. Like, there's one called Crawdad Party. It's kind of my Zydeco song. That one, you know, from a harmonic standpoint, chord changes. I definitely didn't reinvent anything, but it's always a blast to play. And you get a nice melody, and you learn the changes, and then I guess like anything that would be, you know, a jazz or a blues recording, you play the melody a time or two, and then you go over the changes, and you can play whatever you want, and that's the surprise and the fun part. Then you come back and you play the tune again, and then there you go, you got a song.
Is this pretty much recorded live with minimal multi-tracking?
Yes, that's my favorite way to do it. We recorded it live in the studio. There's some minimal overdubs or some acoustic rhythm guitar, and I played a little dobro over the top on a few things. It's 90%+ live with minimal overdubs just to kind of fill up the sound or play a nice melody.
This album has such a strong influence of the blues, even though you're not necessarily working with traditional blues forms. The blues is all over this. It's all in your playing. Is that just the very fabric of who you are as a player?
Short answer, yes. No, I always just like the music. And, you know, my the thing that made me want to play guitar was when I was 5 or 6 years old. I always liked music, but there was one album in particular. It was a Rolling Stones album called Get Your Ya-Ya's Out from the 1969 tour live. And, you know, I mean, they were like bluesy rock, and that's when they had Mick Taylor, who had just come from John Mayall's Blues Breakers. So I guess that really, really stuck with me. And, you know, the music, I was very fortunate. My parents had a pretty good record collection. And my dad would have Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf records and things like that. And then, you know, I remember being little and hearing a lot of, even like the early fusion stuff, the Herbie Hancock Headhunters album that was on constant rotation on the turntable at my house.
You grew up in Huron.
Yes.
When did you pick up the guitar?
I would have been 12 years old, just a couple months shy of my 13th birthday.
And what was the inspiration to take up that instrument? What was it about the guitar that you knew you wanted to play that? You mentioned all the blues records that you're listening to. Is that part of it, or is it just that's the instrument?
I just knew I wanted to be Keith Richards at a young age. That's what I wanted to do for. It's what I wanted to do for a living when I grew up, and I kept with it. And actually, I have a very funny learning guitar story. If you got a moment,
yeah.
Because I always did want to play guitar, and I definitely wanted to sound like an electric guitar. I loved that sound so much. So there was the summer between, I think, was it fourth and fifth grade? I got my first guitar that my grandfather and my mother picked out somewhere. And I was so excited. And they came back, and it was an acoustic guitar. And it was so disappointing. This is not what I wanted. So it sat in the closet for a couple of years before I figured that it's like, well, I'm not getting anything else, so I better start learning on this.
So when did you start playing the electric guitar?
Well, I mean, there's not really, as soon as I could get one, I think my first lesson, I played music from a young age. My parents made me take piano lessons. I played upright bass and viola and like grade school orchestra. My dad played saxophone a little bit. I remember being young and learning just a little bit. So, I mean, I had mostly through piano, so I had a little bit of musical knowledge. And really the big motivation is there was an older kid who was probably, he seemed ancient to me at the time, but he was probably like 18, 19 years old, who lived across the street from a friend of mine who had a guitar and showed me, with the old, all right, play this string open and put this finger on the second fret and hit these two strings type of guitar lesson. And because I did have some musical background, I was able to figure out, oh, well, that's an E note and that's a B note. Oh, this is just like kind of like a piano, but I can carry it around with me. So it's much easier to move.
So would you say that you're essentially self-taught then from that, the older neighborhood kid helping you out?
That's kind of how it started. There was one guy in Huron who gave guitar lessons. I took a few lessons from and learned like your standard G, C, D, A minor open chords.
How do you feel that your guitar playing, your music has evolved in the years over the past few decades?
Well, I think I play better.
Yeah.
I always have better tone. I'm way more versatile. That's for sure. There's a lot of different things I think that I like that I try to throw into my music. It always is going to have the kind of the blues and rock and roll accent, but I can play Misty. I can play a whole bunch of jazz standards. I can make them sound real pretty. I've played with bands that do country songs or, pop songs. So I can do a lot of different stuff.
I'm guessing that as a working musician in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or in this region, that you would have to be able to play just about anything on the guitar.
Yeah, it definitely helps if you want to go out and play. And it's fun. I mean, you'll wind up, even things you think that you wouldn't necessarily like, a lot of times you'll realize it's like, well, that really is a great song, or it's fun to play. And it goes, one time there was, and he passed away not too long ago, we had Joey DeFrancesco, the great organ player, mm-hmm. was in Sioux Falls. And I'm a big fan, so I was really excited for that one. And he gave a clinic, and even though I'm not really I can noodle around and kind of know what I'm doing on a piano or an organ from my young piano lesson days. I mean, it's not my main instrument. I'm like thinking, well, I'm still not going to miss this. I'd go listen to him play anything. And he didn't even play. He just talked about music. And he gave this musical advice. And his advice was that it's easy to play music that you like, because you already kind of know it. You sing it in your head. But if you want to get really good, find a song that you really hate and learn to play it, but learn to play it in a way that makes you like it. Those are words I live by.
Jesse Kristen's new album is Don't Forget to Tip the Band, coming up. Some record release performances, album release performance coming up in Sioux Falls at the Trio Jazz Club Friday, November 15th, Saturday, November 16th. This album, as we mentioned before, steeped in the blues music that you've been working on over the past 8 years. Was there a musical statement that you were trying to make with this album and selecting these songs and putting them together for this album?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of wanted to kick things back to, well, like you said, kind of the blues, and then there's the stuff that's, you know, a close cousin that they would kind of refer to, like the soul jazz. You know, I'll think of a guitar player as a favorite of mine. I don't know if you're familiar with Grant Green.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where it's, you know, you can still play like a standard, but you can do it in, you know, kind of a bluesy fashion. And like the last musical project I did was a little bit more on kind of the crazy jazz fusion. Every song had complicated arrangements and playing a lot of notes. And I wanted to kind of just step back and, you know, maybe return to my roots a little bit on this. But still, you know, still have music that's, you know, I mean, it's, yeah, it'd be kind of in the, at least in the jazz adjacent genre.
Well, Jesse Kristen, a new album is Don't Forget to Tip the Band. Again, live performance. This is celebrating the release coming up on Friday, November 15th and Saturday, November 16th at the Trio Jazz Club. Jesse, congratulations on this record, and thanks for stopping by.
Oh, you bet. Glad to be here.
That was SDPB's Carl Gerke talking with musician Jesse Kristen. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. You can see a lot of our interviews on SDPB's YouTube channel. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.